This text was prepared by Donald Leinson, CHARLIEDirect. C.com. John Leech's Pictures of Life and Character, by William Macapus Thackeray, asterisk reprinted from the Quarterly Review, number 191, December 1854, by permission of Mr. John Murray. We, who can recall the consulship of Plancus, and quite respectable, old Fajafi times, remember amongst other amusements which we had as children the pictures at which we were permitted to look. There was Boydell's Shakespeare, Black and Ghastly Gallery of Murky Opies, Glum Northcotes, Straddling Fusilis. There were Lear, Oberon, Hamlet, with starting muscles, rolling eyeballs, and long pointing quivering fingers. There was little Prince Arthur Northcote, crying, in white satin, and bidding good Hubert not put out his eyes. There was Hubert crying. There was little Rutland being run through the poor little body by bloody Clifford. There was Cardinal Beaufort Reynolds, gnashing his teeth, and grinning and howling demoniacally on his deathbed, a picture frightful to the present day. There was Lady Hamilton Romney, waving a torch, and dancing before a black background, a melancholy museum indeed. Smirks delightful, even ages only fitfully relieved its general gloom. We did not like to inspect it, unless the elders were present, and plenty of lights and company were in the room. Cheerful relatives used to treat us to Miss Linwood's. Let the children of the present generation thank their stars, that tragedy is put out of their way. Miss Linwood's was worsted work. Your grandmother or grandaunts took you there, and said the pictures were admirable. You saw the woodman in worsted, with his axe and dog, trampling through the snow bitter cold to look at, the woodman's pipe wonderful. A gloomy piece, that made you shudder. There were large dingy pictures of woolen martyrs, and scowling warriors with limbs strongly knitted. There was especially, at the end of a black passage, a den of lions, that would frighten any boy not born in Africa, or Exeter Change, and accustomed to them. Another exhibition used to be West's Gallery, where the pleasing figures of Lazarus in his grave clothes, and Death on the Pale Horse, used to impress us children. The tombs of Westminster Abbey, the vaults at St. Paul's, the men in armor at the Tower, frowning ferociously out of their helmets, and wielding their dreadful swords, that superhuman Queen Elizabeth at the end of the room, a livid sovereign with glass eyes, a ruff, and a dirty satin petticoat, riding a horse covered with steel. Who does not remember these sights in London in the consulship of Plancus? And the waxwork in Fleet Street, not like that of Madame Tussaud's, whose chamber of death is gay and brilliant, but a nice old gloomy waxwork, full of murderers. And as a chief attraction, the dead baby and the Princess Charlotte lying in state? Our storybooks had no pictures in them for the most part. Frank, dear old Frank, had none, nor the Arendt's assistant, nor the evenings at home, nor our copy of the M.I. des Enfants. There were a few just at the end of the spelling book, besides the allegory at the beginning, of education leading up youth to the Temple of Industry, where Dr. Dilworth and Professor Walkingham stood with crowns of laurel. There were, we say, just a few pictures at the end of the spelling book, little oval gray woodcuts of Buick's, mostly of the wolf and the lamb, the dog and the shadow, and Brown, Jones, and Robinson with long ringlets and little tights. But for pictures, so to speak, what had we? The rough old woodblocks in the old Harlequin-backed fairy books had served hundreds of years. Before our Plancus, in the time of Priscus Plancus in Queen Anne's time, who knows? We were flogged at school, we were 50 boys in our boarding house, and had to wash in a leaden trough, under a cistern, with lumps of fat yellow soap floating about in the ice and water. Are our sons ever flogged? Have they not dressing rooms, hair oil, hip baths, and bathing towels? And what picture books the young villains have? What have these children done, that they should be so much happier than we were? We had the Arabian Nights and Walter Scott, to be sure. Smirk's illustrations to the former are very fine. We did not know how good they were then, but we doubt whether we did not prefer the little old miniature library knights with frontispieces by Ewens. For these books the pictures don't count. Every boy of imagination does his own pictures to Scott and the Arabian Nights best. Of funny pictures there were none especially intended for us children. There was Rowlandson's Dr. Syntax. Dr. Syntax in a fuzz wig, on a horse with legs like sausages, riding races, making love, frolicking with rosy exuberant damsels. Those pictures were very funny, and that aquatinting, and the gay colored plates very pleasant to witness. But if we could not read the poem in those days, could we digest it in this? Nevertheless, apart from the text which we could not master, we remember Dr. Syntax pleasantly, like those cheerful painted hieroglyphics in the Nineveh court at Sydenham. What matter for the arrowhead, illegible stuff? Give us the placid grinning kings, twanging their jolly bows over their rident horses, wounding those good-humored enemies, who tumble gaily off the towers, or drown, smiling, in the dimpling waters, amidst the anarithmin gelasma of the fish. After Dr. Syntax, the apparition of Corinthian Tom, Jerry Hawthorne, and the facetious Bob Logic must be recorded a wondrous history indeed theirs was. When the future student of our manners comes to look over the pictures, and the writing of these queer volumes, what will he think of our society, customs, and language in the consulship of Plancus? Arinthian, it appears, was the phrase applied to men of fashion and ton in Plancus's time. They were the brilliant predecessors of the, well, of the present period brilliant, but somewhat barbarous, it must be confessed. The Corinthians were in the habit of drinking a great deal too much in Tom Cribb's parlor. They used to go and see Ife in the gin shops. Of nights, walking home as well as they could, they used to knock down Harleys, poor harmless old watchmen with lanterns, guardians of the streets of Rome, Blanco Consul. They perpetrated a vast deal of boxing. They put on the ufflers in Jackson's rooms. They sported their prats in the ring in the park, they attended cockfights, and were enlightened patrons of dogs and destroyers of rats. Besides these sports, the delicacies of gentlemen mixing with the people, our patricians, of course, occasionally enjoyed the society of their own class. What a wonderful picture that used to be of Corinthian Tom dancing with Corinthian Kate at Almax. What a prodigious dress Kate wore. With what graceful abandon the pair flung their arms about as they swept through the mazy quadrille, with all the noblemen standing round in their stars and uniforms. You may still, doubtless, see the pictures at the British Museum, or find the volumes in the corner of some old country house library. You are led to suppose that the English aristocracy of 1820 did dance, and caper in that way, and box and drink at Tom Cribb's, and knock down watchmen. And the children of today, turning to their elders, may say, "And Mama, did you wear such a dress as that when you danced at Almax?" There was very little of it, Grandmama. Did Grandpapa kill many watchmen when he was a young man, and frequent thieves' gin shops, cockfights, and the ring, before you married him? Did he use to talk the extraordinary slang and jargon which is printed in this book? He is very much changed. He seems a gentlemanly old boy enough now. In the above-named consulate, when we had grandfathers alive, there would be in the old gentleman's library in the country two or three old mottled portfolios, or great swollen scrapbooks of blue paper, full of the comic prints of grandpapa's time, ere Plancus ever had the fastest born before him. These prints were signed Gilray, Bunbury, Rowlandson, Woodward, and some actually George Cruikshank, for George is a veteran now, and he took the etching needle in hand as a child. He caricatured Oni, borrowing not a little from Gilray in his first puerile efforts. He drew Louis XVIII, trying on Boney's boots. Before the century was actually in its teens, we believe that George Cruikshank was amusing the public. and those great colored prints in our grandfather's portfolios in the library, and in some other apartments of the house, where the caricatures used to be pasted in those days, we found things quite beyond our comprehension. Boney was represented as a fierce dwarf, with goggle eyes, a huge laced hat and tricolored plume, a crooked saber, reeking with blood. A little demon reveling in lust, murder, massacre. John Bull was shown kicking him a good deal. Indeed, he was prodigiously kicked all through that series of pictures. By Sidney Smith and our brave allies the gallant Turks. By the excellent and patriotic Spaniards. By the amiable and indignant Russians. All nations had boots at the service of poor Master Boney. How Pitt used to defy him. How good old George, King of Brobdingnag, laughed at Gulliver Boney, sailing about in his tank, to make sport for their majesties. This little fiend, this beggar's brat, cowardly, murderous, and atheistic as he was, we remember, in those old portfolios, pictures representing Boney and his family in rags, gnawing raw bones in a Corsican hut, Boney murdering the sick at Jaffa, Boney with a hookah and a large turban, having adopted the Turkish religion, and see, this Corsican monster, nevertheless, had some devoted friends in England, according to the Gilray Chronicle, a set of villains who loved atheism, tyranny, plunder, and wickedness in general, like their French friend. In the pictures these men were all represented as dwarfs, like their ally. The miscreants got into power at one time, and, if we remember right, were called the Broad-Backed Administration. One with shaggy eyebrows and a bristly beard, the hirsute ringleader of the rascals, was, it appears, called Charles James Fox. Another miscreant, with a blotched countenance, was a certain Sheridan. Other imps were Hyde Erskine Norfolk, Jockey of Moira, Henry Petty. As in our childish innocence we used to look at these demons, now sprawling and tipsy in their cups, now scaling heaven, from which the angelic Pit hurled them down, now cursing the light, their atrocious ringleader Fox was represented with hairy cloven feet, and a tail and horns, now kissing Boney's boot, but inevitably discomfited by Pit and the other good angels. We hated these vicious wretches, as good children should. We were on the side of virtue and Pitt and Grandpapa. But if our sisters wanted to look at the portfolios, the good old grandfather used to hesitate. There were some prints among them very odd indeed. Some that girls could not understand. Some that boys, indeed, had best not see. We swiftly turn over those prohibited pages. How many of them there were in the wild, coarse, reckless, ribald, generous book of old English humor. How savage the satire was, how fierce the assault, what garbage hurled at opponents, what foul blows were hit, what language of billingsgate flung. Fancy a party in a country house now looking over Woodward's Facetiae, or some of the Gilray comicalities, or the slatternly Saturnalia of Rowlandson. Whilst we live we must laugh, and have folks to make us laugh. We cannot afford to lose Satyr with his pipe and dances and gambols. But we have washed, combed, clothed, and taught the rogue good manners. Or rather, let us say, he has learned them himself. For he is of nature soft and kindly, and he has put aside his mad pranks and tipsy habits, and, frolicsome always, has become gentle and harmless, smitten into shame by the pure presence of our women, and the sweet confiding smiles of our children. Among the veterans, the old pictorial satirists, we have mentioned the famous name of one humorous designer who is still alive and at work. Did we not see, by his own hand, his own portrait of his own famous face, and whiskers, in the Illustrated London News the other day? There was a print in that paper of an assemblage of teetotalers in Adler's Wells Theatre, and we straightway recognized the old Roman and the old Romans of the time of Plancus George Cruikshanks. There were the old bonnets and droll faces and shoes, and short trousers, and figures of 1820 sure enough. And there was George, who has taken to the water doctrine, as all the world knows, handing some teetotal cresses over a plank to the table, where the pledge was being administered. How often has George drawn that picture of Cruikshank? Where haven't we seen it? How fine it was, facing the effigy of Mr. Ainsworth in Ainsworth's magazine, when George illustrated that periodical. How grand and severe he stands in that design in GCS Nibus, where he represents himself tongued like St. Dunstan, and tweaking a wretch of a publisher by the nose. The collectors of George's etchings, oh the charming etchings, oh the dear old ermine popular tales, the capital points of humor, the delightful chronology and crapbooks of the good time, our time plankuses in fact, the collectors of the Georgian etchings, we say, have at least 100 pictures of the artist. Why, we remember him in his favorite Hessian boots in Om and Jerry itself, and in woodcuts as far back as the Queen's Trial. He has rather deserted satire and comedy of late years, having turned his attention to the serious, and warlike, and sublime. Having confessed our age and prejudices, we prefer the comic and fanciful to the historic, romantic, and at present didactic George. May respect, and length of days, and comfortable repose attend the brave, honest, kindly, pure-minded artist, humorist, moralist. It was he first who brought English pictorial humor and children acquainted. Our young people and their fathers and mothers owe him many a pleasant hour and harmless laugh. Is there no way in which the country could acknowledge the long services and brave career of such a friend and benefactor? Since George's time, humor has been converted. Comus and his wicked satyrs and leering fawns have disappeared and fled into the lowest haunts. And Comus's lady, if as he had a taste for humor, which may be doubted, might take up our funny picture books without the slightest precautionary squeamishness. What can be purer than the charming fancies of Richard Doyle? In all Mr. Punch's huge galleries, can't we walk as safely as through Miss Pinkerton's schoolrooms? And as we look at Mr. Punch's pictures, at the illustrated news pictures, at all the pictures in the bookshop windows at this Christmas season, as oldsters, we feel a certain pang of envy against the youngsters. They are too well off. Why hadn't we picture books? Why were we flogged so? A plague on the lictors and their rods in the time of Plancus. And now, after this rambling preface, we are arrived at the subject in hand, Mr. John Leech, and his pictures of life and character, in the collection of Mr. Punch. This book is better than plum cake at Christmas. It is an enduring plum cake, which you may eat, and which you may slice, and deliver to your friends, and to which, having cut it, you may come again and welcome, from year's end to year's end. In the frontispiece you see Mr. Punch examining the pictures in his gallery, a portly, well-dressed, middle-aged, respectable gentleman, in a white neckcloth, and a polite evening costume, smiling in a very bland and agreeable manner upon one of his pleasant drawings, taken out of one of his handsome portfolios. Mr. Punch has very good reason to smile at the work and be satisfied with the artist. Mr. Leech, his chief contributor, and some kindred humorists, with pencil and pen have served Mr. Punch admirably. Time was, if we remember Mr. P.'s history rightly, that he did not wear silk stockings, nor well-made clothes. The little dorsal irregularity in his figure is almost an ornament now, so excellent a tailor as he was of humble beginnings. It is said he kept a ragged little booth, which he put up at corners of streets, associated with beadles, policemen, his own ugly wife whom he treated most scandalously, and persons in a low station of life, earning a precarious livelihood by the cracking of wild jokes, the singing of ribald songs, and halfpence extorted from passers-by. He is the satiric genius we spoke of anon. He cracks his jokes still, for satire must live. But he is combed, washed, neatly clothed, and perfectly presentable. He goes into the very best company. He keeps a stud at Melton. He has a moor in Scotland. He rides in the park, has his stall at the opera, is constantly dining out at clubs and in private society, and goes every night in the season to balls and parties, where you see the most beautiful women possible. He is welcomed amongst his new friends the great, though, like the good old English gentleman of the song, he does not forget the small. He pats the heads of street boys and girls, relishes the jokes of Jack the costermonger and Bob the dustman, good-naturedly spies out Molly the cook flirting with policeman X, or Mary the nursemaid as she listens to the fascinating guardsman. He used rather to laugh at guardsmen, plungers, and other military men, and was until later. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.